This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, February 12th, 2014. Again, I really want to extend my apologies for last week with the Kosher Kitchen Crash Course with the recording failing in the middle. I had a huge, huge amount of fun doing that. I hope if you came, you like that too. Maybe if I give a chance to give it again someplace, we'll try to get the recording up. Unless, I don't know, maybe it's just sign from God that, you know, right, well, you quoting call, Shulchan Aruch is somehow...
I was going to say, you know, call it a crash course, you're kind of jamming the faith there.
Well, not exactly, because, I mean, again, the whole point was, you know, it's not going to be comprehensive.
Right, like, and, no, I mean, it's crash as in...
Oh, very good, thank you, thank you. See, it's good that you guys are learning something from me. Anyway, so today, thanks to a suggestion made by Josh, going to discuss, this was initially done in a series in the Rabbinic Thought and Theology, but the truth is, it is probably just as relevant today as it was back then. And I call this Segulot Simanim and Superstitions, simply because I like alliteration. And there's a lot to cover here, so this is going to take us like for a couple of weeks. And I'm going to say from the outset, we're not really going to get a straight answer. I mean, the big question that we're going to try to, you know, address that we're not going to get an answer to is, we do a whole bunch of things that might be considered strange. We've got a whole bunch of rituals. On the other hand, and we'll discuss today some of the basics for it about Avodah Zarah, about idolatry, where does that line really get crossed between what's idolatrous versus a decent enough minhag, right? Just to give you one example, because this comes up on a regular basis, in fact, this past year, someone in Israel, I'm blanking on who, said that that Israel needs to ban the practice of kaparot because it's pagan. Now, that's based on, actually, Shulchan Aruch, who, based on Beit Yosef, is getting it from Ramban, right? Swing a chicken over your head, that's, you know, chicken gets your whatever it is, you know, gets your sins, shechta, whatever, that's idol, you know, that's already pagan, right? Now, for others, they say, wait, how could this be pagan? This is a holy sacred custom, right? So there you've got a nice little debate there about, well, should you do it or should you not do it, and how do all those things work? On the other hand, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we've got in Judaism that could, from this perspective, seem a little bit on the wacky end, for lack of a better term. Meaning it's going to be, you know, try to come up with a conceptual difference, Azazel versus Kaparot. Well, functionally, isn't it doing the same thing, with the exception that God mentions Azazel, and he doesn't mention Kaparot. So that's a pretty important distinction there, too. So we're going to spend a lot of time going through...
What is Azazel?
Oh, the Seir to Azazel, what is known as that scapegoat, part of the Yom Kippur service, where you have that little lottery, you know, one goes out in the... No? I'll tell you, well, we're going to get to it, you know, we get to Sefer Vayikra in, you know, a couple of weeks, and okay. Next Yom Kippur, pay attention to the Siddur, and, you know, come, yeah, it's, what? Incidentally, I mean, doing the Gemara, it's not an easy, easy topic at all by any means, but today you've got so many different types of segulot, some that might come to mind are segula wine. Right, which is, this is the wine that you drink at a wedding that, you know, I'm not sure if you pay attention at the end of a wedding, but with the Sheva Brachot, you've got this little, you know, pouring thing going on. You got these three cups because you've got one cup that you've got the person who's saying Birkat HaMazon on because he's being Mevarech al HaKos. Someone else walks around with the other cup and whoever says the Brach holds onto that cup of wine. And at the end, what they do is, you've got this third cup in the middle, pour one little bit of one into the middle, a little bit of the other in the middle, and you pour from that middle to both of them, so that you've got three cups of wine, that have a mixture of each one of those three wines, one the chassan drinks, one the kala drinks, and one is drunk by the guy who is leading benching. There's some people who have the opinion that if you drink from the segula wine. The reason why it's Segula wine is because, well, hey, this is, you know, helps you get married. Which is kind of weird, because I never knew how alcohol will actually, like, solve everyone's emotional problems that's preventing them. There was also a woman...
Alcohol's been responsible for a lot of sex.
Well, there is that, and perhaps even more, you know, poor decisions, too, or at least out in Vegas. There was a woman who was going around recently, I did not commit her name to memory, about, you know, pay her money, you'll get segulas, and you got a whole bunch of things. The schlissel challah, you know, baking the key into a challah, right? That's a segula for something. Doing all of these extra sort of rituals of, like, because there's some meaning that's, you know, that we've managed to infuse with them. And what's really the boundary lines for that? At what point is it okay and what point is it not okay? I'll share with you one more. When I was in Rav Zvulun Lieberman Alav HaShalom's class at YU, I started with him Hilchot Nida and Hilchot Avelut. And he was a Rav of a Sephardi community. And he was telling us once about some really out there customs some people have. The one that reminded me, that stuck in the back of my head, was if there was a family which, God forbid, lost multiple family members in a year, they would take a lock and throw it into the grave, saying that the ground should be locked up from taking more people of their family. And I raised my hand. I said, Rabbi, I don't get it. How is this not a Avodah Zarah? And he said, you're right, but then isn't the time to tell them. Which is an incredibly astute answer, and that's also why in shul periodically I try teaching, you know, the laws of Avelut, because there's also a stigma attached to learning the laws of Avelut, even though it's something which most people are going to have to endure at some point in their lives, or the normal passage of life is that we intentionally keep people, I guess we kind of do intentionally keep people ignorant, because we don't really talk about it, right? It's an ayin hara. You're going to have, like, an evil eye. Like, you can't learn the laws of Avelut because it's somehow, these are laws that almost everyone's going to have to know. Mm-hmm. When the time comes, you don't know what you're doing, and superstition and emotion can take over so much, and people get really worked up over things because, you know, there's just so much to juggle in such an emotionally heightened state. So those are going to be the types of questions that we're going to look at from a bunch of different directions. As I said at the very beginning, for as much as I've tried to come up with an answer, I don't have one. But we're going to have fun, you know, explaining why there is no answer. So that's important to keep in mind. Okay, so let's start off with the very beginning. With, you know, an assumption that, you know what, we've got this prohibition of idolatry. So let's talk a little bit about that prohibition. You start us off, this is... Well, 1 second, it's a Mishnah Sanhedrin 7-6 okay. For the, you know, people following along.
He who engages in idol worship is executed. It is all one whether he serve at sacrifice, offer incense, make libations, prostrate himself, accept it as a god, or say to it, thou art my god. But he who embraces, kisses it, sweeps or sprinkles the ground before it, washes it, anoints it, clothes it, or puts on its shoes, he transgresses a negative precept, but is not executed. He who vows or swears by its name violates a negative precept. He who uncovers himself before Baal Peor is guilty, for this is the mode of worshiping him. He who casts a stone on Mirkulis thereby worships it.
All right, and do the Gemara Sanhedrin 60b.
What is meant by whether he serve it? Rabbi Jeremiah said, this is what is meant. Whether he serve it in his normal way, or sacrifice, or make libations, offer incense, or prostrate himself, even if those acts are not the normal world mode of worshiping that particular deity. Why is blood sprinkling not included, Abiah said? Because sprinkling is the same as offering libations. As it is written, their drink libations of blood will I not offer.
Okay, so let's quick summary here. Avodah Zarah literally means foreign or strange worship. And it can be applied in different ways. There's a wonderful book by Moshe Halbertal on this. My father's Rabbi Chacham Yosef Faur actually wrote, if I'm remembering correctly, the entry for idolatry in the very first Encyclopedia Judaica. There was a reboot of that. Anyway, so here you're talking about worshiping what we might call idolatry or idol worship, even though it's not necessarily an idol. Let's call it a foreign god. Mm-hmm. And the Gemara explains, it's not just worshiping any other foreign god, it's whether or not this is the way that they're normally worshipped, right? So let's say I decide I'm going to worship Zeus by baking a cherry pie, right? It seems to be like, you could say, well, that's not the normal mode of worshiping that deity. That's my intention is like, I don't know, likes pie. I don't know. Problem, right? Don't do that. There's also an issue of avoiding perception of Avodah Zarah. Josh, Gemara Chulin, Mishnah Chulin 2:9.
One may not slaughter in such manner that the blood runs into the sea, or into rivers, or into vessels, but one may slaughter into a pool of water, or when on board ship onto the back of vessels. One may not slaughter at all into a pit, yet a person may dig a pit in his own house for the blood to run into. In the street, however, he should not do so, lest he appear to follow the ways of the heretics.
All right, and the Gemara in Chulin 41b.
One may not slaughter into the sea. Why is it that a person may not slaughter into the sea? It is not, because it might be said that he is slaughtering to the deity of the sea. Then, is it not the same when a person slaughters into a pool of water? For it might be said that he is slaughtering to the image reflected in the water. Rabba answered, this was taught only regarding turbid water.
Yeah. So the concern is, if you're going to shecht in a certain way, it will appear that you are shechting to the god of the sea. So you might not be doing it, you might not even have the intention of doing it, but there is a concern about the appearance thereof. If I'm remembering correctly, it was one of the examples we had in Marita Ayin, of like something that, I'm trying to remember this, I believe it's in Avodah Zarah, about drinking from a water fountain that like happens to be right in front of an idol, right? So you go down like that, and that's forbidden because of Marita Ayin, it looks like you're actually bowing down to the thing. So there's a concern for doing something like that too.
Is there something about davening outside and praying to the trees? I don't remember if there was something I vaguely remember hearing something like you shouldn't daven outside.
Well, then you'd have to explain Kabbalat Shabbat.
Kabbalat Shabbat?
Yeah, because they used to go out in the field.
Oh, I don't know. It's something that I vaguely remember hearing. It could have been.
There's other things about like you know praying to like in front of mirrors and the like, but I'm not sure to what you were referring because people at one point or another did pray outside. They didn't really have a choice.
That's fair.
All right. Okay, then. So, all right, let me just, a little mark here. Okay. Now, we can pretty much get, I mean, I don't want to belabor the point that idolatry is somehow bad. Okay? A lot more we can talk about that Yahavor. But there's a really strange Gemara, which is where things start to get complicated for us. He said this is a Gemara Sanhedrin 67b.
Abaye said, the laws of sorcerers are like those of the Sabbath. Certain actions are punished by stoning, some are exempt from punishment, yet forbidden, whilst others are entirely permitted. Thus, if one actually performs magic, he is stoned. If he merely creates an illusion, he is exempt, yet it is forbidden, whilst what is entirely permitted, such as was performed by Rav Hanina and Rav Oshia. Who spent every Sabbath even studying the laws of creation, by means of which they created a third grown calf and ate it.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, here the term is keshafim, sort of witchcraft and sorcery. We've got, for those who were following along in the Hilchot Shabbat class, exact same analogy. You've got things that are biblically prohibited, things that are rabbinically prohibited, things that are permitted. What's permitted? Oh, you've got Rav Chanina and Rav Oshio who every Friday study the laws of creation, Hilchot Yetzirah, and created a third grown calf and ate it. Now, yeah, I'm not giving you any answers on this. Any thoughts so far?
What are the laws of creation?
I don't know. We did not learn that in YU Smicha. I guess you could ask, this is why rabbis aren't that creative. I see. Yeah. Any thoughts on this? Permitted witchcraft.
It's odd.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Certainly is. Yeah.
Well, it is, the implication is, it's perfectly fine that you're studying Torah and it just... you accidentally, while you're doing it, just happen to create something. That's fine.
Yeah, no, well, it doesn't seem to be accidentally if they did this every Friday. Right? This seems to be a recurring practice.
So it's not just like that, innocuous like Dathiyoni or something.
Is the difference between actually performing magic and performing an illusion like a magic trick? Like that way of saying a card trick is all right?
So it depends what you mean today, like with illusions and stuff. Mm-hmm. And to what extent do you consider stuff done today, like what we call magic tricks, to really be illusion? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to even come close to mm-hmm. posturing on someone's act or another. We're going to be discussing things like this about what exactly is the difference between magic and, I mean, I do have my own approach to like the question of magic, and if you don't, I'll get to that at the end. If I don't say it, remind me. Mm-hmm. What's a good example? There was a great series in England from Penn and Teller called Fool Us.
Yeah, great show.
Great show. You might be able to even find it on YouTube. Here's what the deal was. They would bring out various forms of magicians, including illusionists, including card trick people, and they were supposed to do a trick in such a way, well, not in such a way, but they were supposed to do a trick that neither Penn nor Teller knew how to do it. That's why it was called Fool Us. If they did manage to fool them, Penn and Teller would bring them to Vegas and, like, put them on the show, right? Now, for people today, and certainly like that, is it really an illusion? No. This is trickery. People know that it's trickery. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone who thinks, like, this is real. There is some elaborate, elaborate stuff there, right? Now, again, what does that apply here? I don't even know how today's magic would even do that, because no one goes to these people. Well, I shouldn't say that. For, say, a typical magic show, people go there to be entertained. It's not like you've got, some shaman in some backwater place who's using it to be like a mystic person, even though they know, well, I'm not really doing it, It's also, a little bit weird about what does it mean, thus if one actually performs magic, right? So it says here, ha'ose ma'ase b'skila. What does it mean to actually perform magic, mm-hmm. right? Shouldn't that be a better question, right? You ask about illusions, right? So let's say somebody, what makes you think you actually perform magic?
I figured, actually performing magic, I don't know, when I hear that, I think, I think back to, Moshe and Fornaparo, and, the sorcerers and snakes and all that,
Yeah.
Magic.
Now, yeah, so, assuming that such a thing exists, mm-hmm. and this gets to the next thing, well, does that mean that there are, in fact, other powers out there which can be manipulated? I mean, you get into some theological questions here, too, that really underlie these magical questions, and we'll bring it back to Sigillo, afterwards, too. So here's what we got in section 4 here, discussion on the existence of other powers. Devarim 4:35 has what some people have called the only, biblical statement regarding straight up monotheism, or at least what we call monotheism, the only existence of one God. It says, you are shown these things that you might know that the Lord is God. Besides him, there is no other. I mean, previously in the Torah, you had God is one, right? But that's one entity. But you also don't have before you other gods. Mm-hmm. Well, does that mean other gods exist? Mm-hmm. Right? In theory, that could. Here, you've got a pasuk in Devarim, Deuteronomy 4:35, there is no one but God, right? But there you go. So what about, these other things? You've got Gemara in Sanhedrin 67b, right? Same page of what we saw before. Rav Yochanan said, why are sorcerers called kashafim? Because they lessen the power of divine agencies. There is none else besides him, Rabbi Chanina said, even by sorcery. A woman once attempted to take earth from under Rabbi Chanina's feet. He said to her, if you succeed in your attempts, go and practice it, meaning sorcery. It is written, however, there is none else beside him. But that is not so. For did not Rav Yochanan say, why are they called mechashefim? Because they lessen the power of divine agencies. Rav Chanina was in a different category, owning to his abundant merit. So here we seem to have a dispute about what exactly, are there other powers floating around out there that can be manipulated and the like? What do you think?
Certainly seems to say that there could be.
Well, at least one. So why are they called Meshachim? Because they lessen the power of divine agencies. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that seems to indicate that there are some other things floating around out mm-hmm. there that will be on the spiritual plane that are not God.
Mm-hmm. And also, another bizarre thing, when Rabbi Hanina says, if you succeed in your attempts, go and practice it. based on what I assume is something not too far away, shouldn't he have said, if you succeed in your attempts, I'll have you stoned?
Yeah, you know, so that's an interesting point there, too. Unless he was, like, pulling an Eliyahu, right? Eliyahu HaNavi at Har HaCarmel set up, you know, one of your original celebrity deathmatch things. You have, like, our, you know, he had his korban on one mountain. Priests of Baal had theirs on another mountain. He said, all right, let's see whom God chooses. So it could just be his way. It's like, you know what? You can do this. Like, fine, go ahead type thing. You know, it's like knowing that this is just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Let's continue. The Gemara 65b, going back a couple of pages in the Gemara, just not here. Other different types of things.
Our rabbis taught a Baal Og is one who speaks from between the joints of his body and his elbow joints. A Yidioni is one who places the bone of the Yadoa in his mouth and it speaks of itself. An objection is raised, and thy voice shall be as of one that hath a familiar spirit out of the ground. Surely that means that it speaks naturally. No, it ascends and seeks himself between his joints and speaks. Come and hear. And the woman said unto Sheol, I saw a godlike form ascending out of the earth. And Shmuel said to Sheol, surely that means that it spoke naturally. No, it settled itself between her joints and spoke.
Anyone remember the story about Sheol?
It's like, right, yeah.
All right, hold on 1 second. Okay, so you have the story here is in Shmuel Aleph, chapter 26:6. Reading from the translation that we got here. Saul disguised himself. He put on different clothes and set out with two men. This is, 1 Samuel 28:8. Saul disguised himself, put on a different clothes, set out with two men. They came to the woman by night, and he said, please divine for me a ghost. Bring up for me the one I shall name to you. But the woman answered him, you know what Saul has done, how he has banned the use of ghosts and familiar spirits in its land. Why are you laying a trap for me to get me killed? Saul swore to her by the Lord, as the Lord lives, you won't get into trouble over this. At that the woman asked, whom shall I bring up for you? He answered, bring up Samuel for me. The woman recognized Samuel, and she shrieked loudly and said to Saul, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. The king answered her, don't be afraid. What do you see? The woman said to Saul, I see a divine being coming up from earth. What does he look like? He asked her. It is an old man coming up, she said, and he is wrapped in a robe. Then Saul knew it was Samuel, and he bowed low in homage with his face to the ground. Yeah, and things actually, you know, don't really go well for Saul. So you have this story in Navi, all right? Now, if you want to take this as historical fact, then, you know, raising the possibility of, well, raising the dead, kind of, sort of, you know, that there is some way of divination where you can actually speak. I mean, that whole, you know, thing that Saul says, by the way, you know, I swear to God you're not going to get in trouble, is all sorts of ironic. But yeah, I mean, let's just even start dealing with the belief of there being other powers aside from God or some other metaphysical things that are subject to manipulation. Maybe. All right, let's move on here. Gemara Rosh Hashanah 16b. If Teresa, we're up to you, or Josh.
What he means is, why do we sound a tekiah and a trua? Sitting and then again sound a tekiah and trua standing. It is so as to confuse the accuser. Rabbi Isaac further said, if the shofar is not sounded at the beginning of the year, evil will befall at the end of it. Why so? Because the accuser has not been confused.
All right, so accuser here is translated as Satan, right? Which you all know is Satan, right? So what do you think of... and we got one more. Risa, take Gemara Yoma 20a. Another one about Satan here.
What about Satan? He answered, Satan has no permission to act as accuser on the Day of Atonement. Whence is that derived? Rabba Bar Chama said, Hasatan 2 in numerical value is 364. That means on 364 days he has permission to act as accuser. but on the Day of Atonement, he has no permission to act as accuser.
Now, when you have things like this here, right, you've got this almost personification of Satan. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. I think we might get to at some point things unlike the Malach HaMavet, who, you know, takes on a really strange persona in certain Agadot. And the question is, to what extent, you know, could you say Chazal really believed in this, right? Because you kind of have this dichotomy, and there's a whole bunch of issues about, you know, the existence of, how to put this, well, Satan in the sense, I mean, how to put this, our concept of Satan, you know, at least in the rabbinic Judaism, might be very different than the popular thing of Satan, which we probably assimilated from Catholic theology and mythology, right? So, but in any case, whether or not you think this Satan or Satan, you know, is a half, you know, man, half hoof demon, horns, tail, you know, trident thingy, talks like Flanders. Okay, Simpsons Reverend being. Anyway, so, but there seems to be some alternate, again, being here, right? Could perhaps be part of the whole celestial retinue. I mean, aren't there a whole bunch of malachim, right? A whole bunch of angels. Maybe Satan's just one of them, just doing his job. That apparently we can somehow manipulate by blowing shofar. Now, did Chazal, you know, I mean, this is a tricky thing that people might read into. Either way, like, did, you know, some people can super read into this and that, you know, really believed that by blowing the shofar, we are affecting something in the metaphysical realm. Others, you know, will rationalize this to say, well, they're giving you a metaphor. And both of those types of approaches, and I don't just mean specifically, I mean, those approaches and those types are ways that people usually read, they say more about the person who's giving them than about what Chazal say. Because again, you're trying to get into Chazal's head and say, well, what did they really think? And usually people are projecting. Right? Like, well, this is what I think they must have meant. And when you do that, you could pretty much reinterpret anything to anything else. I'm not going to bother doing that. I'm just pointing out that the Gemara does mention this. And according to at least Pshat here, something is going on. What, why, don't know. But it's there, which means we got to at least somehow deal with it. Can't pretend it doesn't exist. Moving on. Take also Sanhedrin 67b. Reese, I'll do it fine. You have her up to me. Sorry, I keep forgetting that. So the magicians said unto Paro, this is the finger of God, Etzbe Elokim. This proves that a magician cannot produce a creature less than a barley corn in size. Rav Papa said, by God, he cannot produce even something as large as a camel. But these, larger than a barley corn, he can magically collect and so produce the illusion that has magically created them. The others he can't. So here you seem to have a dispute, too, about even the Chartume Mitzrayim. According to one opinion, there was actual magic done. According to the other, no, this was all an illusion. And wrap it all up with Yoma 77b. The school Menashe taught, Hashem Ben Gamliel said, a woman may wash her hands in water to give bread to an infant without any fear. It was reported about the older Shammai that he would not hand food to be eaten even with one hand, whereas the rabbis decreed that he must do so with both hands. Why is that? Abayi said, because of Shibta, an evil spirit or odor that endangers the health of those who eat food touched with unwashed hands. So that's it for, you know, just today's thing. But we got a bunch of stuff to talk about here. Because, you know, at the end, when we're talking about Segulot Simanim and superstition, this gets to be tricky. Meaning, assuming that there's some sort of logic behind any of these invented Segulot and whatnot, what's the relationship between, you know, God and how stuff works? The distinction that I tend to make regarding things like magic, and this comes up regarding prayer, and I, you know, say that, one second, let me actually, so here's an example, of what I mean with a distinction. This is, this is Rambam, Hilchot Avodah Zarah, Laws of Avodah Zarah, 11:12. Halochish al-hamaka, v'kori pasuk mina Torah. If you spit over a wound and you recite a verse from the Torah, you know, and similar things, you know, skip through a bit here. Miniach sefer Torah tefillin al hakatan bishvil sheyashan. You put a Torah tefillin by a kid so that he sleeps. I have no idea if that works. You know, lo dai lahen shehen bichlal chaveri menachashim ela shehen bichlal kofrim b'torah. These are people who deny the Torah. Pretty harsh words from Rambam. Shehen osin divrei Torah refuat haguf, because they are taking the words of the Torah and turning it into the healing of the body. Ve'einan ela refuat nefashot shenamar vayuchayim lenafshecha. These are only healing the spirit, but not actually intended to, you know, used to heal the body. Aval habari shekarei psukin or mizmor tilim kadesha tekein alav zechut lekriatan ninatzel mitzurat nizikin hareze mutar. But let's say you're just reciting mizmorim like Tehillim as a means of prayer and supplication, so that you should be worthy and you should be meritorious to be saved. That's okay. To my understanding, the difference between, say, prayer and magic is, what are your expectations? If you use magic, or a perception of magic, is one that says, if I do something X, Y is going to be the occurrence. If I say these prakim of Tehillim, then so-and-so will be cured. Right, as opposed to, I'm going to say these prakim, these chapters of Tehillim, in order to help pray for someone, and maybe they will be cured. It's a matter, in a sense, of power. There's a wonderful book I have on my shelf about, you know, the psychology of superstition as a means of controlling things that are outside of your control. A friend of mine, Sean Brown, is met him in Chicago, sociologist. Yeah, did some stuff on superstitions and sports. Like sports players happen to be very superstitious. Wade Boggs, anyone remember what he used to do?
Have different wives in different cities?
I don't know. I don't recall that, but his superstition, he would etch chai in the dirt.
Uh-huh.
Got him in the Hall of Fame. You know. Well, no, that didn't get him in all. You know what I mean. So when you, there are so many things that are outside. Like, they've got lucky socks, right? Rally caps. You don't talk to a pitcher if he's, you know, about to throw a no hitter because you don't want to jinx the guy. All of that stuff, superstition, things that are not really in your control. You kind of make stuff up to think that you kind of have control over these things. If your approach to this stuff is doing these things means you can control God, that is super duper problematic. Mm-hmm. Because you can't control God, right? Now, you could ask another question here. It's like, well, what about controlling all those other metaphysical creatures too? Right? So, for example, let's take the whole Segula wine thing. If you drink the Segula wine, this is supposed to help you get married. We know that, you know, in the physical plane, that's really not true. How is it supposed to work on the metaphysical plane? Is it that you're somehow tweaking God, right? That's problematic. Or you're appealing to some other power that's floating around out there that can somehow change the fates in your favor. Problematic, perhaps, in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my own approach, and this is a total conjecture that I've read, you know, seems to have made sense, I've gotten some, where I was like, yeah, that makes sense for me, is when it comes to the segula, just like when you talk about prayer, you know, you can't view it as a means of, if I say these words, someone will get healed, or I can somehow control God. Like, they used to say God is being your ATM machine, right? It's not that God just does whatever you say, otherwise that's not really much, you know, divine power and all that, because then you actually control God. God doesn't run the world. It's just you happen to know certain magical formula and you can chant whatever. So when it comes to the segula, the rule of thumb that I tended to use was, the more you take it seriously, the bigger of a problem it is. And the distinction would be, well, what if you don't do it? An example I got from Rav Tendler one year, he said there was some woman who came to his door, needed to do kaparos. He was like, he wasn't about to, you know, go and, you know, start doing, you know, he might have like done it with money or something, was like, wasn't going to do it with the chicken. And she had actually told him, she firmly believed, she didn't do kaparot with the chicken, she was going to die that year. Now, you can laugh at that, you know, but that's your real test. Let's say one year you don't do kaparot. Is there any difference that you think that's going to bring on for the rest of the year? The more that you think there is, the more trouble I think you get into with Avodah Zarah. Again, that's a matter of conjecture, it's a matter of degrees. If you think that, you know, somehow if you didn't drink that Sugala wine, it means you're never going to get married, bigger problem. Then you run to, I think, more problems. Like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, whether it's, you just like, you know, down's like, yeah, hey, look, free wine. Yeah, you know, nice simcha. Right? Chardonnay or whatever. And assuming it's, you know, you're not actually mixing different types of wines, you know what I mean. You know, then it wouldn't matter as much because it's like, yeah, couldn't hurt, but you don't actually take it that seriously. And this, you know, these are things that can get very complicated, especially if it's something's been perpetuated for a certain number of years. Then you have to go back and say, well, where did this come from? At the very least, you know, when you go back to like the Seir LaZazel or to any of the mitzvot that we do, which to an outsider might seem really nuts. Why do you take a lulav and esrog? Right? Kind of seems a little strange. Why are you blowing this ram's horn? Right? Also seems strange. And I'm sure, you know, you can come up with others. At least in those cases, if you're, you know, starting with that very fundamental assumption that the Torah represents the will of God, well, then God tells you to do this. Right? You may or may not get the reason for it, but at least, again, if you operate with the assumption that the Bible represents the divine will, you're doing the will of God, and, you know, God's not, you know, ought not have a problem with you doing what God wants you to do. The bigger question comes up when you've got these newer things that come up that have a very mystical bent to it or some underpinning that people somehow believe and want to take on. What roles do that sort of fit in here? We're going to listen, you know, learn a lot more about these in the next subsequent weeks. And for as much as when I, you know, first put this together, as much as I wanted to find a formula of like, this is okay and this is not okay, I could not do it. I mean, like, you know, certain things I mentioned before are not going to be okay, but reading from, you know, the laws of creation and creating a, you know, calf every Friday, that's fine. You know, how to put this? I can understand why super hyper rationalists would want to say disqualify everything, but you're going to have to, you know, need to have some rules or some systems behind it simply because otherwise, you know, you've got stuff in the Gemara. You're going to have to deal with the Gemara, right? That's why I like studying the Gemara. It's like it's one text that pretty much every Jew acknowledges is part of the Jewish canon. So if it's here, it's one thing, like I can quote like some wacky guy from the 15th century who no one's ever heard of. It's like, oh, you see, it's like, well, no one really cared. It's in the Gemara. You can't really shy away from it that much. We're going to see some things that, you know, from a super rationalist perspective might make people uncomfortable. And some can say, well, you shouldn't take it literally. And that might certainly be an approach. But when you're talking about, again, the metaphysics, no one necessarily knows for certain. And in terms of what does it mean for what are the things that you truly, you know, have to believe, if you really believe Ein Od Milvado, right, there's nothing, you know, no spiritual entity apart from God, and you also believe that you don't control God, you want to take those two positions, then having all these additional superstitious beliefs, by which I mean not just doing, you know, the rituals, like drinking wine at the wedding is not a huge deal, but if you actually believe that this is going to affect, you know, when you're going to get married, you know, although I'll conclude with this that might actually help, is a line my grandfather used to say, if you drink Coke for 100 years, you'll live a long life. You know, so there's some correlation there. Anyway, so this is just part one. I hope to see you for Laws of Shabbat this Sunday.